From the Radio Cafe and the Kivira Coalition, this is Down to Earth, the Planet to Plate podcast. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'm very happy now to welcome Dr. Hisham Moharram. He is founder of the Good Tree Farm and the Good Tree Inc., a nonprofit organization in central New Jersey. And this is the second part in our series on an initiative called Faithlands, which is about the intersection of faith and regenerative agriculture. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So you are here visiting New Mexico, and you started this Good Tree Farm, and then the other work that has sprung from that, not only as an initiative in regenerative agriculture, but also as an expression of your faith as a Muslim. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, Islam is a way of life. It's not a religion that we practice at certain aspects, certain times of the day. And you are a Muslim all the time. At work, at home, at play, whatever you're doing, you have to live and exist as a Muslim, which is basically someone who's their mission, regardless of race, tongue, culture, skin color, our mission as human beings, if we're Muslim, is to please God. Doesn't matter what language you use to do that, doesn't matter which culture you're part of, you just live a life that pleases the Almighty, the Creator. So for me, as a Muslim, an Arab American, and a scientist, I did the traditional route for a long time, which is to go the academia route, scientific research, and basically the career track of most scientists in, you know, to have a scientific career in a university or in one of the big companies that hire scientists for profit-oriented scientific research. 16 years almost, but basically I've always had an issue with the system as it is, even within scientific research, because it's driven by the values of society as a whole and around the world these days. It's increasingly so now compared to decades back. It's driven by the values of capitalism and generating profit. And that spills over into how a scientist exists as a scientist. We are supposed to be amongst the professionals that are most observant of honesty and integrity and truth. You can't be a scientist and fabricate your data. You can't be a scientist and lie about what your findings are. People's lives will depend on them. People's investments will depend on them. You can't. And yet, I saw it. I saw people willing to change research findings and results and conclusions because the source of the grant funding didn't like the initial version, or would not promise continued grant funding if the conclusions of the research wasn't more favorable to the private sector grantor.
We saw that in the sugar industry, which paid off a lot of scientists in, I think, the 1950s or 60s to try to get them to say that sugar was less harmful than fat, for example.
Yes, yes. And actually, fat, sugar, and salt are those three key components that feed a part of the brain that actually develops an affinity for those three things. And people develop cravings for them just like drugs. And they figured that out a long time ago, and that was the three axes around which food was marketed for a long time and continues. But for me, I'm a Muslim, so on the Day of Judgment, I'm going to be asked how I spent the years I was given and everything that I was blessed with. Whether I was a rich man or a poor man, I'm going to be asked, how did I spend what I had? If it was $10,000, there's going to be a question about that. If it was $10 billion, there's going to be a question about that. It doesn't matter. What you know, how did you use it? Was it to profit for yourself, to manipulate, to quote-unquote get ahead in today's society? Or was it to benefit others and to fight for what's right and protect the environment and other creatures around you? Were you an actor for justice, or were you an actor for injustice with what you were given? So I wasn't, and I'm not rich, but I had a PhD and many years and experiences doing scientific research and traveling abroad that gave me a very unique perspective and ability that I knew I'd be asked about. And in addition to that, I had many discussions leading up to the time when I started the farm where Americans who weren't Muslims would say, we don't see the Muslim contribution to American society. We see the Jews have libraries and civic centers and hospitals. They've got charities that help people. And where are you?
You literally heard that? People asking you that, challenging
you? They would say things like that and say, you know, you come here, most of you come with degrees, higher education, and you get high-paying jobs, and you build yourself a nice homes and send the rest back home. But you don't give to America anything. You're closed on yourselves in your mosques, and, you know, we don't know what you guys are doing. So for me personally, the answer was, okay, I'll show them. And let's start an organic farm. It was a sound idea for many of my fellow Muslims. They said, yeah, we love the idea, and we should show the rest of America what practicing Muslims think and do about something that has nothing to do with international politics. Although, looked at from another way, organic and food justice issues are very political.
Right.
But there are aspects that Muslim voices haven't been heard in. So here we are.
So what happened next? What did you do?
So it's been 11 years, a long process. We started, we bought the land in spring 2007. Times were good. The future prospects were really rosy. By the end of 2007, do you remember what started to happen? The financial crisis, Bear Stearns and all of that. And I'm like, we're a farm. How is that going to affect us? Boy, was I wrong. So we were a startup. The land we bought had nothing. No sheds, no barns, no home, no, just empty land. We put in a lot of all the infrastructure, really. But the budget we had in spring 07 was blown out of the water because in very quick succession, what happened was the financial crisis, the housing crisis, and within the first 18 months of the financial crisis really getting going, the fuel prices went from $1.25 in the spring of 07 to 4 plus in Jersey. And all of a sudden, everything we had budgeted for was 3-4 times as much. So it really hurt us financially in executing our business plan. Most agricultural startups, in normal times, they predict 5 years to profitability. We just started making a profit a couple of years back.
So it took almost twice as long.
It took almost twice as long. But there's more reasons, because after these man-caused hurdles, which we did survive, and we survived, I'll give the credit to one thing that we did as Muslims. Islam does not encourage or condone loans with interest. We never took out any loans. We didn't owe any bank anything. Had we would have probably sold part or all of the farm to pay loans we couldn't pay.
Very interesting. So Muslim people don't get mortgages?
They are supposed to not take loans with interest. So there is, for mortgages for homes, there's opinions where if you have to, you're allowed. But if you don't have to, look for the alternative that Islam provides. And that's where the Islamic financing of homes, which is a growing industry in America, came in.
So tell us about the farm and what you actually do there.
Okay, so it's 55 acres. We took the first phase of our existence to put in infrastructure and fix problems that it had, as far as drainage, water supply, leveling and grading of the fields, putting in roads, building greenhouses. We put in two wells. So the plan was to secure ourselves as a business on the waterfront and on the energy front. We succeeded with the wells because we did those first when we still had money and the impact of the crises wasn't as bad. But the renewable energy, we couldn't get to it before our budget was blown out of the water. So we're still struggling on that. But any startup in food production should secure itself in the first few years with a secure water supply and a secure energy supply, whether through wind or solar, to be independent. So you don't have to be constantly paying for all these necessary daily inputs, so that when a Sandy hurricane comes through, you're not out of power.
What do you grow on the farm?
So the farm has two aspects of it. One is the edible crops for people to consume, and the other is crops that are, you can call them industrial crops. They give products that feed an industry. So for example, essential oil crops give you essential oils, which are the raw material for a lot of things. A lot of the creams and perfumes and colognes and air fresheners. They might have synthetic scents, but often they have natural essential oils. There are crops that give you compounds with a bioactivity that is medicinal of one sort or another. Those are medicinal plants. Those are the ones we're focusing on for the profit-generating aspect of the farm. But the food-generating aspect, that had more to do with the food justice mission of the farm than the profit mission.
Tell us about the food justice aspect.
Okay, so when you look at organic food, people who can afford the convenience and the quality of whole foods are usually people of means. A certain minimum, at least, because it's a hit to the household budget if you're always buying most of your groceries, etc., from Whole Foods. The prices are more. Even the organic section of normal supermarkets, the prices are traditionally more. So it puts products like that, which are very necessary for healthy development, especially of children, beyond the financial capacity of a lot of the lower income brackets in society, regardless of their race or culture or religion background. There are white people who are Christian who can't afford organic food. There are black people who are Muslim or Christian who can't afford organic food. There are Hispanics who can't afford organic food. And it has to do with the fact that those demographics in any society, really, not just America, are overworked and underpaid. So they often have two or three jobs to make ends meet, and they barely make ends meet, and they sustain the fast food industry because they go to the dollar menu.
And so you are growing food and selling it at a price that is affordable to those communities?
Yes. The mission has evolved since that initial beginning. Now we are locating 501c3s, a church, a mosque, a Catholic school, or a Montessori, a faith-based Montessori school, a Muslim school, a faith-based free clinic, whatever it may be, a 501c3, and we bring them in as shareholders, as investors in the project. So they're part owners, but they also get their own greenhouse. Every season, they have a greenhouse available to them and part of the field to grow their own food. They decide what they want to grow, they manage it, and they harvest it and take it and do with it what they want. They can sell it, they can give it to their congregation, they can use it for helping the poor, whatever they want to do.
And how's that going, and what kinds of challenges have they had along the way?
So just like when someone's starting to garden and they haven't gardened before, they're learning by making mistakes.
Right.
So there's mistakes being made. Some of them are things I warned of. But it's kind of like parenting. I say this and I'm sort of worried that people take it the wrong way. I'm not speaking with my nose in the air. No, I'm just saying I've learned by raising three girls that the best lessons they've learned are the ones where they may have heard my advice, but they didn't take it. They went the route they wanted. They made the mistake, learned the lesson. They never make it again. The communities are the same thing. They listen to you, take some note of what you said, then they decide, nah, well, we'll do this, yeah, but this one we'll do it this way. And you say, but they go ahead. End of the season or midway through, you know, you were right. Yeah, I know I was right. You had to go through it to realize I was right.
What are some specific examples
like
of that?
Like, for example, don't grow okra in the greenhouse. It takes up a lot of space and it produces tiny fruit for you. It's not good use of space. So there's one greenhouse where there's like 10 okra plants that I discovered are there the other day because I hadn't walked the greenhouse for a while. They put them in even though I said not to. The ones in the field are doing great. The ones in the greenhouse are doing better in terms of size, but they're crowding out everything around them. So they've lost productivity per square foot because it's the wrong crop in a greenhouse.
So in terms of fulfilling the mission of actually feeding people good, healthy food that wouldn't have access otherwise, are you seeing that happening?
Yes, because what they're doing now is they harvest and they take back to their communities. It teaches them a lot about their communities as well. Just because the idea appeals to everyone doesn't mean everyone in the church or the mosque will be there when the harvest is taken back and will take the harvest back home or will want to pay for it. Some of them tried to sell it to the community members at a low price just to make costs and stuff because they have to drive out to the farm. So there are costs that the community has to put up. And some of them decided, no, we'll just give small shares to people when they come. And others decided, no, we're just going to take it and donate to communities we know are in need. Not our own mosque, not our own church. But there ends up usually being a variety of ways that they dispose of any particular harvest one week or another. One week it may end up all going to the food pantry in a church down the street. Another week it may all go to the community members because guess what? They happen to be there at this in the right numbers at the right time when the harvest was brought back and they liked what was there. So they took it. So it depends. But they're finding out a lot more about their community preferences and what crops they really will want next season versus what they decided to grow this year. I think that's really good.
So there's a lot of things going on here. I mean, one is a kind of entrepreneurship where you are really learning about your community and supply and demand and all of that and how to at least break even. Another is providing healthy food so that you have healthier communities. And another is really challenging the system of industrial agriculture.
Yeah.
And trying to play a role in putting in place a local regenerative agriculture system.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is Islam teaches us to plan as though we're going to live for 1,000 years in terms of worldly needs, but plan for your judgment day as though you're dying tomorrow. Right? So the plan is that we want to open up as many community-owned good tree farms as possible. Set up a network around every major city. Community-owned, faith-based, focused on these issues that fight climate change and industrial agriculture and provide entrepreneurship opportunities and give people food security and independence. And will we get there? Not in my lifetime. Am I going to try? Yeah. That's one of the reasons I'm here.
There's also a lot of thinking about, and I wonder how the conversations are going with the many people that you work with about climate change, about soil health, about pollution, and those things. When you're doing organic and regenerative agriculture, you are, in a small way, depending on the size of your farm, contributing to a cleaner world.
Yes. And one of the most important things that is happening is individuals in a church may be interested to read or hear or watch things about climate change and the impact of industrial agriculture. It's another thing when they're involved in an alternative. They enter into discussions. They, on a very personal level, interact with difficulties that the alternative needs to solve. They begin to understand why so many people gave in to the model of industrial agriculture with its facilitation of the crop growing process. One spray and you're done with all your weeds versus, oh, you have to mulch regularly. Oh, you have to weed regularly. Oh, you have to do this. There's a lot more time and effort involved in producing healthy food than there is in producing cancer-causing food. It's one thing to talk, and it's another to actually be involved in the actions that are the alternative we want to create. They begin to appreciate, for example, the act of growing food and the food itself a lot more than if they just simply went to the grocery store and paid for what's right there in front of them.
And there's also a sense of hopefulness in that, instead of the kind of incessant drumbeat of despair that many of us are trying to contend with.
Yes, and they begin to see what their own potential is. So they can see why certain crops fail, why yield may not be great, but they can also see how some are doing really well, or what it is they did at what time that allowed this crop to reach more of its potential. And they begin to realize that there is a lot they can do in their own locale. It may be a suburb of a big city, but they still can do a lot of things to achieve food independence and not have to go to buy the industrial agriculture food products.
How are you working with young people?
That's one of the most important groups. So everything that I'm doing is so that the youth of as many of these minorities and disenfranchised groups in society get a chance. There's a video I saw on Facebook, actually, where someone was trying to demonstrate the aspect of privilege and how some people start out life disadvantaged, so far behind everyone else. So they got a group of kids, multicultural, multiracial backgrounds, and they lined them all up in a park. And then they asked everyone to take a step forward if the thing that they were going to say was something they had, whether it's a parent who's paying for your university education, or are you working to pay for your education? There's a whole list. But when they were done, a lot of the people who are privileged, the race hasn't started yet. They were almost halfway to the finish line. Everyone else was a step or two away from the starting line. And they said, okay, now this is real life. On your marks. Get ready. Go. Well, it's a no-brainer who won the race. And it knocks the message home like nothing else. The system is set up with disadvantages. So those youth that want to start a business, if their parents are working two or three jobs and they barely have $50, $100 every end of the month in their bank account, they're not going to be able to get help from their parents for that. Someone who has well-paid parents probably is given monthly stipends, and maybe, mom, dad, I have an idea for a business. Oh, yeah, let's sit down and see what we can do. They'll give them their time. They'll give them their mentorship. They'll give them the financial cushion as they make mistakes and get on their feet. Youth from minorities that are disadvantaged never have that opportunity. What I'm trying to do with the farm is to provide that. In the field of local food economy around producing food through a farm.
And how's that going? Tell us about some of these young people that you are working with.
So the communities that we have involved, we have this year a free clinic in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, became invested, and they have their own greenhouse. And a small Muslim community in Willingboro, New Jersey came in this year as well. their community came out and set up the greenhouses. Those that are actually doing the seasonal work and managing the greenhouses and harvesting are the youth of their community. They came to me and they said, okay, Dr. Hisham, it's obvious some of the things we grow, the community doesn't want. So we want to talk about next season and what crops we can grow to make sure we can make money. That is very important, that they come to you wanting mentorship on how to basically become successful entrepreneurs and business people. A lot of them are women, by the way, too. Hands down, sisters beat the brothers all the time on this.
What's up with that?
I don't know. I think maybe the issue of producing food and farming in the mind of a young man is more of a woman's job. I don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's gender dynamics going on as well. But guess what? Money moves everybody. When they see the ladies making money and counting after the sale of the harvest, attitudes change.
That's an interesting motivator.
Yes.
So, I mean, when you talk about the people to, you know, step forward and who wins the race, I mean, education is such a huge part of that. And then the other part of education is having somebody along the way who believes in you.
Yes.
And who's kind of walking you through a little bit.
You know those father-son landscape management teams that you often see? That's what the dad is providing for the son. The son may start doing this with his dad in high school. He keeps doing it through university. And by the time he's done with the university, he may have a management degree or a business degree or maybe something in a totally different field. But oftentimes, what they happen to find is this. Dad is getting tired. He's ready to retire. He's got this big list of customers and a business I know inside out that's making maybe more than $100,000-$200,000 a year. Why would I go with my degree and be an employee for 40 when I can run my father's business and he can retire and I can take it from 200 to 400,000? His dad provided the mentorship. His dad was there to absorb the mistakes as he made them. The minorities and the disadvantaged groups of society never have that. So that opportunity to learn by doing versus learn by lecture is crucial for any entrepreneur. So we have an incubator concept in the business plan where, let's say someone wants to come and do a business around honey products. They can do that with us. When they're ready to peel off and be their own business, we can either buy the farm's share, or we can be business partners with them and bring another incubator person to be in the incubator to take the honey for the next season, because they're already peeled off. But that way we can teach by doing multiple entrepreneurs, even if it's in the same field. Once they're ready to flap their wings, they can fly off.
Now, do you see this as a kind of benevolent niche within capitalism or an alternative, or how are you conceiving of that?
There's a phrase that I heard, it's called patient capitalism, which is basically you are focused on profit, but not with the same greed and impatience that is often the case with anyone doing a capitalist-based venture. There's also social responsibility, which is a phrase that they started using, where a business, big or small, shows the community it's in a little bit of a different face from the bottom line motivated business. Now we're also maybe helping beautify a park or cleaning up a neighborhood or youth programs, funding the local Y or something like that. They're calling these socially responsible activities by a for-profit business. Well, patient capitalism can combine that by simply putting into place profit-generating activities and others that are profit-generating on a partnership and a support mechanism basis where you understand that this won't make as much money because you're having to teach people who are making mistakes and learning. But when you do that, they end up stronger individuals for the community that you already are a part of. So as you graduate more and more of them, you strengthen the local food economy, which is something that businesses like Walmart decimate, regardless where they go. We need to strengthen that again. But then now the agribusiness, I prefer to call it that instead of a farm, has all these supporters who are former graduates, and now they're successful business owners in their own right with their own niche that they have chosen, and they're still local right here. The local politics changes, the local spending changes, the local economy strengthens. A lot of the problems in society because of people not having jobs and having too much time on their hands and being victims of prostitution and drug dealers, etc., start to dwindle and diminish and maybe hopefully go away.
Have you seen any of that? I mean, people who were victims of prostitution and drug dealing and local politics changing as a result of your farm?
Not our farm yet, because we haven't gotten to that impact level yet. But throughout the 11 years I've been doing this, I'm always monitoring and watching and reading and talking with others, like, for example, some of the attendees of the Faithlands gathering in California. The impact is there. It just depends on how far developed the group is with what they're doing. You know Will Allen, for example.
Yeah.
Well, Will Allen is an example of how that has, in fact, made those changes for the inner city's youth.
Will Allen is an urban farmer in
Yes.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Yes. He's a perfect example of how mission-focused businesses like what I'm talking about can, in fact, save kids from drugs and homelessness and prostitution and all sorts of things.
So what does your quote-unquote growth model look like? Because when you talk about patient capitalism and you're both a for-profit and a non-profit organization, you know, side-by-side organizations, and impatient capitalism, greed-based capitalism, sort of domination-based capitalism, which is kind of antithetical to the very principles of regenerative agriculture,
yes,
works in a different way, but you're still looking to really grow the business that you have in such a way that the model can be used beyond central New Jersey, right? What do you have in mind?
Okay, so we are like the fingers of a hand. Any one of these fingers by itself can do a certain amount, but very little compared to what the five fingers of a hand can do together. So I look at us and I say, okay, what if the poor suburban or urban churches and mosques and synagogues allied with a lot of those unchurched, unmosqued youth that are often the victims and the prey of these negative influences we mentioned earlier? What if we partnered with them? What if we teamed with them and formed interfaith community-based ventures that are designed, business design, such that it empowers, literally empowers, with knowledge and with entrepreneurship opportunities, those at-risk segments? It changes the demographic realities in terms of finance, in terms of opportunities, in terms of emotional, psychological outlook to life. It changes the community. Police officers should be interested in what I'm doing. City council members should be interested in what I and Will Allen and many others are talking about. Yeah, we're literally taking kids off of the streets. We literally are taking kids out of the parks at night. We literally are giving them hope for the future and faith in themselves. We're giving them an opportunity to build their own self-confidence. Those opportunities, many people don't want to give them because they fear the cost.
Would that be, I mean, sometimes there are faith-based organizations that say, we'll give you this in exchange for becoming part of, I mean, would you require or would you want them to become part of a faith-based church?
No, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, one of the most important groups we all spoke of in the Faithlands gathering is all those youth who find themselves shunned and rejected at the church or the mosque or the synagogue because they're challenging the ideas and the status quo that the older generation imposes. They want to ask difficult questions. They want to raise thorny issues. They want to be political. They want to experiment in ways that church leaders, you know, no. We don't want to try doing that. No.
Like what?
Or mosque. Like, for example, they want to start bringing aspects of their faith into how they're doing their business and bringing that into the church's or the mosque's activities. Well, if you're going to start talking about the politics of food production, hey guys, we're a 501c3 and we're Muslim. We can't be talking about politics. This is dangerous. FBI will come and talk to us. They'll think we're agitators. No. Don't bring that here. They need a third space. And that, whether they're Christian, Muslim, atheist, whatever, established systems don't like to be rocked. So where are those youth going to go? They need a third space. What I'm talking about is third spaces for them. That farm can be the place where their activism blossoms, if I can use that phrase.
You are a very, what one might call, devout or faithful Muslim. How did your own faith develop?
So when you read the Quran or listen to the Quran, God is repeatedly giving us human beings examples of his benevolence and generosity and kindness and mercy in the world that he created for us. This is the way Muslims look at everything. This planet Earth is God's creation. Everything on it, everything outside in the universe is the creation of God Almighty. We will never, with our limited intellect, ever be able to grasp what God is. He created us. How can we grasp him? So what we do understand and believe is none of us can create the wing of a mosquito, which is actually a challenge that was posed in the Quran. Here we are, 1400 years later, we think a lot of ourselves with all the technology that we have. Has anyone created the wing of a mosquito that is of the same material as the real wing of the mosquito? People have created what they're calling mechanized mosquitoes, right? Miniature mosquitoes. But they're made from, are they biological materials? No.
Although that is apparently the next frontier, which seems a little Dr. Frankensteinish to me. But
the point is, there are limits that we are not going to be able to traverse because they're in God's realm. Like, for example, the soul. Has any scientist been able to tell you, my mother passed away 3 years ago? Who can tell me what her soul is, what it's made of, how it left, how it went into her body in the first place, how it interacts with the physical flesh and blood body that we have? No one knows. So what the farm experience has done for me and my faith is it made me reflect on verses I used to hear before and gloss over their meanings. Now I am standing in the farm praying my noon prayer and I'm reciting verses that mention the wind, and a breeze is running by my cheek and my ears, and I'm experiencing the gratitude for that. I'm experiencing the awesomeness of that moment, and it's just a breeze. I see all the time insects in various stages of their lives. I have a video up where I videotaped a praying mantis laying her sack of eggs. And then later that sack of eggs, next season, hatching, and those little praying mantises coming out. And it's just awesome. So that phrase that many Muslims and Christians, I would say, are taught to say, praise be God, or Allahu Akbar, that's what it means, God is the greatest. When I say it now, it's like, wow, because what I'm seeing with my eyes or experiencing is making that worth a lot more than if I said it 100 times in the mosque, which is brick and mortar and air conditioned and fluorescent lights. I'm in God's kingdom. I'm in God's mosque. I'm in God's church, right out there, you know.
In nature.
In nature. And the supreme is not me, is not the engineer, is not the architect. It's God Almighty. And yet, this is where I get my food, my clothes, my shelter, my sustenance, and my faith. So it has strengthened it, and it made my relationship to the Quran far more meaningful. And I keep on telling my brothers and sisters in the mosque, wherever I go, that phrase. You want to come and you want to experience what the Quran is talking about a lot more? Come to the farm. Come and have a picnic, for God's sake. Sit in the sun and enjoy. Just listen to the rustling leaves of those awesome trees and think about the awesomeness of creation around you. You want to increase your faith? Come and do that. Come and see how the soil that we grow our plants in is alive. It's organic. So all the microflora and fauna haven't been hurt by herbicides and pesticides and high rates of mineral fertilizer. Everything is natural. Everything has its place. And it's an ecosystem. It's a web. It's everything's connected. And you're part of it.
So you are here visiting New Mexico. Tell us what you're doing here.
So I'm here to try and establish, you might say, a second Guthrie farm, but mainly they can call it what they want. My main purpose is to work with stakeholders, strategic partners, people who speak my language, if I can say it that way, and have the same goals as I, so that we can build that coalition that can build and maybe replicate and customize a Guthrie farm model here, where we get people from these groups that we mentioned earlier to become part owners, to run farms and practice entrepreneurship on their own and grow within the local food economy here, and grow it and strengthen it, and maybe keep on buying farms and establishing more and more. Because ultimately, if you think about it from the issue of local food security, so that you don't have to all of a sudden not have access to lettuce because there's E. coli outbreaks in California, you need to have your own food production here that you can rely on, especially in times of crises. So for every major city, if I can get the youth and the faith groups to basically ring the city with different types of agribusinesses that provide inputs for the local food economy, then we've grown that community's food security. We've helped a lot of the fragile and at-risk groups and empowered people as well.
I think probably many of the people listening to this program have a pretty good sense that the current industrial food system is unsustainable in many different ways. First and foremost, that it is really bad for the soil, and eventually the soil cannot continue to produce food if it's being mistreated. Do you see regenerative agriculture ultimately displacing the current industrial system, or how do you see that kind of a transition?
It may not displace it, but it should be able to take a pretty good share of the market out there from it. Because the average customer, when they go to buy food, they are not callous to the impact of industrial agriculture on climate and the ecosystem and other species and human beings. They actually know, most of them know what's happening, and they don't like it. But the realities of life dictate the final purchasing decision. What they can afford, and what they have access to, and what they can rely on. So if it's local, they can rely on it. If it's local and with patient capitalism as the basis, it can be priced to still generate a profit and an income for those that run it, but be a little bit more merciful on your wallet. And if it's local, then if problems start, you can stem them quickly before a whole industry has a shutdown of a particular product and it's not available. There's a lot more control. So you can take a substantial portion of the average customer's spending by addressing the issues of convenience. So multiple retail outlets, multiple production locations around a major city, and pricing that makes it affordable for everyone, not just those who have a really good income coming in. If you do that, then yes, you can really impact how much of the food market industrial agriculture takes to their shareholders versus stays in the local economy here.
Dr. Hisham Moharram is founder of the Good Tree Farm and the Good Tree Inc., which is a nonprofit, and you can find more about them on the web at thegoodtreeinc.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're most welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to Down to Earth, a production of the Kivira Coalition and the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. If you like this program, please share it with your network. And we'd love your feedback. Go to downtoearth.media, where you can contact us and you can sign up for the mailing list. You can also like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're producing this show bi-weekly and would love your comments and ideas. So once again, downtoearth.media. And check out the Kivira Coalition, kiviracoalition.org. That's Q-U-I-V-I-R-A. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.